from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Right-wing armed groups in Ukraine are now openly threatening journalists and, apparently, without comment from the Western media. Members of the neo-fascist group Right Sector have reportedly put a $10,000 bounty on the head of RT's Graham Phillips, who's currently working in the east part of the country, and an RT camera person working in Odessa was informed by the acting Ukrainian authorities that he, too, is a target. RT's editor-in-chief, Margarita Simonian, said in a statement, quote, "Our cameraman Stringer in Odessa received a phone call from the Ukrainian Security Service, who said that he is now on the radar of the Right Sector and that his former colleagues gave him up," closed quote. Simonian's statement came after RT's correspondent Irina Galushka said on her Twitter that the cameraman she's working with had also received threats. And another RT journalist, Paula Slyer, found herself in the middle of fighting near Slavyansk. She filed this report.
A little bit behind these trees is the TV center, which is currently in the hands of the Ukrainian army. We saw in the last few moments a rocket flying over, so we're going to try and get a little bit closer to determine exactly what's going on. The road to the TV center has been blocked by a train. So just on the other side of that train is going to be the Ukrainian army. Okay, so that the rocket fired at the wagon from a helicopter, but that it's the anti-Kiev demonstrators who closed the road. Let's make a run for it. This way at least we're out of sight, hopefully, from the snipers, and we can get to the railway cart, the back route. Okay, so we're here. We're closer to the railway cart. I want us to get even closer and just try and talk to the guys about what's happening. We saw the rocket coming over.
from the sky, I think.
From the sky, and it fired on. And it fired on where? Right there. That's the hall it made.
That's all.
The guy's telling us to go inside the building because it's very dangerous here, and he's asking if we want a cup of tea. I think tell him, not at the moment, thank you. I see Molotov cocktails here. You can actually see the guy preparing them. One of the guys here just warned us to keep low because he says they're on top of the TV building, snipers, and they're shooting at anything that moves here. The guys are actually hiding underneath the railway line with rifles. Okay, the guys are actually telling us to go. So let's just make our way through the field. But there's some guys here with guns. Here's a guy with a gun.
Не снимайте лицо, пожалуйста. У меня сестра в Италии, она меня убьет. У меня сестра гражданинка Италии.
What is he saying?
His sister in Italy. If she sees it, she will kill him.
I have parents in South Africa. If they see me, they're going to kill me.
The reported threats followed a weekend of violent attacks against protesters in eastern Ukraine that left casualties on both sides and a spreading and stiffening resistance to the acting government in Kiev. On Friday, pro-government operatives set a mob upon a union hall in Odessa, where hundreds of anti-government protesters were trapped inside the building, which was set ablaze with Molotov cocktails. While acting officials in Kiev put the death toll at 42, Vadim Savienko, a deputy of Odessa Region Council, said that some 116 people died. He called the action a punitive military operation in Odessa by Kiev. That accusation was echoed by Oleg Tsaryov, a protest leader and former presidential candidate who withdrew from this month's scheduled presidential election. Tsaryov said that the acting government in Kiev, quote, doesn't have the right to investigate this case because the current government organized everything that was going on in Odessa, closed quote. Also on Friday, local self-defense forces managed to down three military helicopters as troops supporting the coup-imposed government in Kiev intensified punitive operations in the southeast of Ukraine. Kiev has intensified attacks on Slavyansk and other protester-held cities since Friday morning. So far, government troops have managed to blockade transport to and from Slavyansk, but haven't made significant territorial gains, utilizing hit-and-run tactics. And a Ukrainian Army Mi-24 attack helicopter was shot down Monday near Slavyansk as armed clashes between regular troops and pro-federalization protesters continued. Kiev's acting government also suffered another defection of its security forces, this time barely 200 miles away in the city of Poltava, whose unit of the former Ukrainian riot police Berkut had been ordered to the eastern Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk for so-called mop-up operations, but they refused to carry out the order. According to a Russian senator, Igor Morozov, citing confidential sources inside the unit, a commission from Kiev has been dispatched to Poltava to force the officers to join the military operation. On Sunday, it was announced that the mayor of Donetsk, Alexander Lukyashenko, resigned and handed over authority to the self-proclaimed People's Republic of Donetsk. A press statement by local activists read in part, quote, "The power is being transferred into the people's hands. That's why the keys to the city were handed over. Peaceful people came and asked him to resign, and he did so. Everything was peaceful," closed quote. The head of the Donbas People's Militia, Sergei Tsiplakov, told RIA Novosti that pro-autonomy forces are now taking control over all of Donetsk and the administrative buildings there, and local health officials say 43 people remain in hospitals in the Donetsk region with injuries sustained in violent clashes and military operations across the region. Since fighting began around March 13th, nearly 500 people in and around Donetsk have asked for medical attention. Meanwhile, Russia is warning of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in the eastern Ukrainian cities that are under blockade in the ongoing military operations. The Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement that there is an apparent lack of medicines and shortages of food supplies are beginning to occur, urging that, quote, "those in Kiev who are organizing terror against their own people to come to their senses, stop the bloodshed, pull back troops, and sit down at once at the negotiating table," closed quote. We'll have more on Ukraine later in this newscast. Panama's Vice President Juan Carlos Varela has apparently won Sunday's presidential election, according to the country's election tribunal. Varela was an ally of incumbent President Ricardo Martinelli before having a falling out with him. With over 60% of the votes counted, Varela had 39.2% of the vote. Erasmo Pinella, head of the election tribunal, told Varela by telephone, quote, "You are the next president of the republic," closed quote. After winning the race Sunday, Varela was congratulated by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who by telephone stated his hopes for normalized relations between the two countries. Observers predict that the outcome of the election will be a closer alignment of Panama with the emerging integration of the region and a more independent line from Washington. A recent unity deal between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas is bringing greater security cooperation to Gaza and the West Bank, or is it? We have this from Press TV.
Thousands of Palestinian police are to be transferred from the West Bank to the Gaza Strip as part of the recent unity deal between Hamas and Fatah. A senior Hamas official in Gaza has announced the transfer of 3,000 police personnel. He says the Islamic Resistance Movement has made a, quote, "strategic decision to move on with reconciliation and do what is needed to implement the agreement." Meanwhile, Azam Al-Ahmad, who is a key Fatah figure in the reconciliation, is planning to visit the Gaza Strip for talks about the formation of a unity government. The rival Palestinian factions reached a landmark unity deal in April and agreed to finalize an interim government within 5 weeks. To discuss that further, and I'm joined by Ashraf Shannon, Press TV's correspondent, who's joining us live now from Gaza. Now, Ashraf, what are experts saying? How significant is this step?
Well, Vakar, first of all, it's not 3,000 police officers or security men from the West Bank coming to Gaza. It's actually, they will be picked from the thousands of police officers, Fatah police officers, who are still in the Gaza Strip, and they stopped working since the rift began in June of 2007. There are thousands of police officers and thousands of employees in the Gaza Strip who still receive the salaries from the West Bank, but they do not perform work in Gaza. And out of the thousands of the security men in Gaza, from them, this is what Mr. Abdussalam Siam said. He is the Secretary General of the Hamas government in Gaza. He said that 3,000 security personnel will be merged with the Hamas security forces in Gaza. that's part of the in the future formation of a Palestinian technocrat government, which will be discussed next week upon the arrival of Mr. Azam Al-Ahmad, the senior Fatah official. But there was no confirmation from Fatah officials regarding the integration of Fatah forces in the Gaza Strip with those of Hamas, Waqar.
And Ashraf, you know, Hamas at this point is going forward enthusiastically with this reconciliation process, as we've seen the statements by Hamas officials. How are Gazans feeling about this reconciliation process at this time, though?
Well, when they signed the unity deal, at least on paper, last month, a lot of people were happy and joyous about this event. But this is not the first time that Hamas and Fatah sign unity deals. They really signed that twice, once in Doha and once in Qatar in the past 2 years, but also remained in paper. So the mood in Gaza is of pessimism regarding the possibility of unity. They hope that the Palestinians will unite, but they don't see it happening anytime soon. Although Hamas has made some steps to improve the situation, they've decided that as of tomorrow they will allow a newspaper from the West Bank, the host newspaper from the West Bank, to be circulated in the Gaza Strip after being banned for 7 years. And they also said that they will release security prisoners. They're referring to Fatah men who were imprisoned in Hamas jails in the past years.
So Ashraf, finally tell us, is it that Gazans are wary of the leadership of Mahmoud Abbas at this time? Do they not trust him? Is that the reason why they are pessimistic going forward?
The thing is, it's not about being worried about who's the leader. You know, that for the past 7 years, the people of Gaza have went through two wars, an ongoing Israeli blockade, and there's a sort of confusion, or thinking there is no clear future for them. That's the situation that most people in Gaza are facing right now. They don't know what's going to happen. They don't know if the unity is going to happen. They don't know if unity is actually is going to be beneficial for them.
44 years ago this past Sunday, on the college campus of Kent State in Ohio, four students were killed with rifle fire from the Ohio National Guard while protesting expansion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia. 10 days after Kent State, two students were killed on the campus of Jackson State University by the Mississippi State Police, also for protesting the Vietnam War. 4 years after the events in Ohio, eight of the guardsmen were indicted by a grand jury for willfully violating the rights of the dead and wounded students, but those charges were dismissed by a judge who said the government failed to prove its case. In 1979, each family received $15,000 and a statement of regret from the U.S. government for what happened on that day, but no one has ever been held accountable for the deaths of the four students on their college campus, and no apology has ever been offered. The family of Allison Krause, one of the four killed students at Kent State, and Emily Kunstler, the daughter of William Kunstler, who defended the Chicago Seven, established the Kent State Truth Tribunal in 2010 in light of new evidence in the form of digitized audio tape showing that the guard was responsible. This past March, Krause's sister Laurel appeared before the United Nations Human Rights Committee in its fourth periodic review in Geneva, Switzerland. Krause requested an independent, impartial investigation into the Kent State massacre. The tribunal's submission in 2013 that led to their invitation made clear that it believes, quote, failure to ensure justice and accountability for the Kent State massacre has set a precedent that the U.S. can continue to harass, abuse, and even kill protesters, close quote. Krause was at a memorial of the murdered students Sunday, where she described the hearing at the UN this past March.
What happened is two of the members of the Human Rights Committee asked multiple questions about the Kent State massacre, where four died and nine were wounded. Basically, they asked about excessive use of force. They asked about command responsibility. Specifically, are the commanders ever looked at? about the commands that they're giving? Is there any culpability involved in that? Which is very specific to Kent State. Also, they talked about accountability, and that made it so that the U.S. had to respond. You know, some groups had no one bring up any issues. They never even made it. But we had two members bring up multiple issues related to Kent State, so it was a huge win for us. And we were delighted, and that's what we were trying to get. But we were very surprised when the United States Justice Department, a representative there, his name is Roy L. Austin, Jr. He's Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. And he began his talk, his response, to the Human Rights Committee. He was answering their questions, and he had to. He said, in 1970, four students were killed, were murdered, nine wounded. Not injured, actually, because it's the first time the United States government has ever admitted to murder at Kent State. And it happened March 14th, 2014, this year.
As we reported Friday, the crisis in Ukraine was the subject of an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council called by Russia in response to the military assaults on protesters by Kiev. Radio VR's Kels Hetherington spoke with journalist Vasily Shushko in New York after the meeting.
What happened at the meeting of the Security Council?
Well, it was, of course, a response to the latest chaos that has unraveled on the ground in Ukraine. There are reports that the Ukrainian military has begun staging operations in response to many of the uprisings taking place in southern and eastern Ukrainian cities, cities that contain predominantly pro-Russian populations. This meeting was simply to address those reports. These reports were the first such reports of Ukrainian military action on the ground, and Russia felt an emergency meeting of the Security Council was necessary to address these blatant concerns. The meeting itself, Kels, lasted about 2 hours. It is the second meeting on Ukraine this week, the 13th meeting on the Ukrainian crisis overall. And just like most of these previous meetings, there was a lot of the same, a lot of name-calling, a lot of playing the so-called blame game, the United States and many of its Western partners blaming Russia for the escalated tension and violence in eastern and southern Ukraine, whereas Russia voiced its concern over Ukrainian military operations and the use of military force against its own people. Russia's UN ambassador Vitaly Churkin calling the steps taken by Ukraine very dangerous, and they could result in harsh consequences. The ambassador also said, quote, "We demand the West to reject its destructive policy with respect to Ukraine. We also demand those who took power in Kiev to immediately stop their pushing operation and any other violence against their own people, to free political prisoners and allow all freedoms for journalists." Now, Kels, the meeting did end with a call by Russia for all parties to end all violence on the ground, but this was merely a recommendation, not an official unified statement from the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council clearly not unified on the issue whatsoever.
Now, Russia asked for this meeting. What was it hoping to get out of the discussion?
Well, it was simply hoping to address the concerns of Ukrainian military operations. This is really the first day that we're hearing these reports, reports of Ukrainian military personnel going into many of these eastern and southern Ukrainian cities, cities that have since been taken over by pro-Russian supporters. And now we see Ukrainian troops on the ground going into these cities. That is a concern that Russia Russia wanted to address. Some may say it somehow it backfired, being that the majority of the Security Council did blame Russia for much of what was going on. But really, Russia wanted to put its cards on the table and say what its opinions are. And its opinions clearly are that there should be no military actions taking place on the ground in Ukraine. So Russia had the ability to say that today. It did. What will come from that, we just don't know. Certainly looking towards the future, we can't imagine any sort of unity within the Security Council. We can't imagine any sort of resolutions or unified statements. So whether or not this was a productive meeting, one could argue that it was, one could argue that it wasn't. Clearly no unity within the Security Council. So at the end of the day, words were said, but ultimately nothing was done.
And the relationship between the U.S. and the neo-Nazi thugs who are now in control of Ukraine's security services and the current crackdown on protest in that country were the subject of this report from Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition. He spoke with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar.
The Russian government has been, frankly, afraid that this crisis could grow and grow and go from a regional crisis to an international crisis of the first caliber, including the possibility of a military conflict. But there are forces that are loyal to Russia in eastern and southern Ukraine, forces who are also highly oppositional to the fascist-led government in Kiev. And they are concerned. Unlike what the U.S. propaganda says, that there's no threat to them, they know that there's a threat. They lived during, or their parents and grandparents lived under the circumstances where fascist forces invaded this part of the world, led by Hitler and pro-fascist elements in Ukraine. And there was a virtual genocide carried out at that time against pro-Soviet and Russian forces or anti-fascist Ukrainian forces. They are alarmed because the new government, as one of its first acts, banned Russia as an official minority language. In other words, they could see in the new government not only a far-right, nationalistic, and xenophobic government, but one that was particularly targeting Russians. And I think it creates a dilemma, in fact, for the Putin government, because Putin, while not wanting to escalate the crisis in Ukraine, cannot simply turn his back and ignore the fact that there is a growing confrontation between Russian-speaking and pro-Russia elements in eastern and southern Ukraine against those who are loyal to the fascist-led, or I should say semi-fascist or partly fascist-led government in Kiev. And that puts pressure on Putin. Putin cannot afford to simply stand back and say, we won't be involved, especially since it's all taking place on Russia's border. But I do believe that it's part of the American and Western propaganda to make it all appear as if it's Russia's manipulation. And the fact of the matter is, this entire crisis, including the coup d'etat of February 22nd that toppled the Yanukovych government with fascist forces in the lead, was an act that was created by pressure from the United States, with the support of the United States, and having carried out the coup d'etat, they are unable to or unwilling to take responsibility for the unintended, perhaps, at least, or unforeseen by them, consequences of their actions. And now that the situation has become chaotic and another, I would say, major headache for the Obama administration in terms of its own foreign policy or the way its foreign policy is perceived, they are content with playing the blame game and instead of accepting responsibility for their own role in creating what was a minor crisis and made it a monumental national and then international crisis by supporting the coup d'etat of February 22nd, these same political forces are irresponsibly pointing the finger at Putin and saying, you, Russia, you're to blame, rather than accepting their own responsibility.
Ukraine's forces are reportedly fortifying for military action, and the U.S. has certainly gotten into this fray and indicated that could certainly be a possibility too. What is your assessment of the potential for this to become a full-blown military conflict?
Well, I think all sides don't want it to become a military conflict because the stakes are so high. I think, as I said before, the U.S. acted, U.S. imperialism's own representatives, John Kerry and Victoria Nuland, and of course the ever-present warmongering right-wing militarist John Cain, who goes everywhere to kind of create a sentiment for regime change and intervention. They created the crisis, but I don't think they were able to see very far into the future, because now as the crisis becomes a monumental or potentially monumental standoff and showdown between the U.S. and the West and NATO generally and Russia, they're dealing with a destabilized European situation potentially and the possibility of military confrontation. Of course, Russia is the second largest nuclear power in the world. The Russians, too, don't want a war. The people in East Ukraine and South Ukraine, they don't want a war. They just don't want to live under a fascist-led government that they consider to be anti-Russian. Or they want to affiliate with Russia in a permanent way. But they, too, don't want war. But the danger in these situations is that the situation becomes somewhat chaotic when different forces take a step up what's called the escalation ladder, threatening the other side. The other side matches that step with another step up the escalation ladder. And then you have other independent political forces who have their own agenda. For instance, the semi-fascist and right sector neo-Nazi militias in Ukraine, they've been organizing under the banner of integration into Europe, but their agenda is narrower. It's a fascistic agenda. And in the course of the people of East Ukraine, the pro-Russian forces, they too have a narrower agenda, which is they can't be, you know, they want to live in either inside of Russia or at least free from any sort of threat from the fascists who now control the government in Kiev. And they are not going to just simply say to even a Russian demand that they should step down if it meant them putting themselves in a weaker position in relationship to those who they consider to be an existential threat. So it's in these kind of combustible situations where no one is really fully in control. There's no dominating power that can, by virtue of its sort of hegemonic power, be able to dictate the terms and conditions for whatever resolution comes about. Under these circumstances, things can grow. And thus, I would say, even though none of the parties, including the U.S. in this case, want a war, war is a possibility because the things can have their own dynamic because it is, in fact, a living struggle. At a certain point, the Western forces will feel they have to do something if Russia is not backing down or if the people in eastern and southern Ukraine refuse to give up buildings and land and territory and facilities that they've seized as part of their own sort of reconstitution of themselves as an autonomous republic. And Putin can't appear to be functioning with lassitude or apathy or as simply a bystander. All the forces are being compelled to act in ways that they might not have wanted to act and that they had not anticipated they would be in this situation even 6 months ago. The U.S. and particularly the EU provoked this crisis back in November when they gave the Yanukovych government, which was not pro-Russian but wanted to have a balanced relationship between the EU, between the United States and NATO powers and Russia. In other words, not integrate into Europe on the basis of abandoning the historic economic and political ties with Russia. But because Yanukovych was presented with an ultimatum that he did not accept, that became the triggering event. The ultimatum presented by the EU became the triggering event for a protest movement in Maidan in the downtown Kiev, which started small, less than 1,000 people. But because of the sustained support it received over and over and over again by John Kerry, by Victoria Nuland, by the neoconservatives, by John McCain, by the EU powers, that movement became a strong movement and a formidable movement and ultimately a movement under the control of neo-Nazis whose own narrow agenda was to seize the power for their own narrow fascist agenda. But when they did so, the Western forces, including both EU and the United States, congratulated the new government, congratulated themselves. They said, this is a historic day in Ukraine, not seeing that this ultimately could be the end of Ukraine as we currently know it, because it set into motion political, economic, and military forces far, far beyond what they had anticipated.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.